Chapter 14, Midlife Transition. Bobby had had several girlfriends and was still seeing the London socialite Rebecca Fraser when he met Emily Black in a law school class at the University of Virginia in September 1978. A petite, quiet, and attractive brunette, she was a Midwestern girl, daughter of a schoolteacher mother and a stepfather who managed a lumberyard in Bloomington, Indiana. Her biological father had died of a heart attack when Emily was two, and she had two siblings. In 1968, she'd been a teenager in the crowd when Robert Kennedy came to her hometown to campaign in the Indiana primary. Asked what attracted him to Emily, Bobby told me, "She was super smart and super funny and curious about everything. She'd come from very humble roots, through her own hard work and brains, made it into one of the best law schools in the world. She could hold her own in any conversation with our circle of friends, people like Sheldon Whitehouse and Chris Bartle, and lots of very impressive people." Bobby wrote of Emily, "She had been raised in a home with an authoritarian stepfather who made arbitrary decisions to justify his power in her life by quoting the Bible. She devoted her life to justice and fighting arbitrary, self-righteous, and moralistic authority." Emily had graduated Phi Beta Kappa in political science from Indiana University and was in her second year of law school when she and Bobby started dating. Their April wedding, a year later in 1982, took place in her hometown church. TV cameramen and reporters came from all over the world. This was American royalty come to the Hoosier State, featuring a mingling from across the generations. Not only Ethel and Uncle Ted, but Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Richard and Doris Kearns Goodwin, Joseph Alsop, and Bobby's other relatives, family, and personal friends, as well as the friends and relatives of Emily. After they graduated from law school in June, the couple moved into the elegant uptown New York apartment that Lem Billings had willed to him. At the time, Bobby had been hired as an assistant district attorney in the office of Robert Morgenthau, a childhood friend of JFK's who'd appointed him United States attorney for the Southern District. Emily was to commence her own legal career as a public defender with the New York Legal Aid Society, helping poor and indigent individuals facing criminal charges. Emily had given birth to their first child, Robert Francis Kennedy III, in September of 1984, and a second child, Kathleen, in April of 1988, nicknamed Kick after his father's sister, the Baroness of Cavendish, who died in a plane crash 40 years earlier. Since 1984, when Bobby started at Riverkeeper, the family had been living in a sprawling white colonial house on an 11-acre estate in Mount Kisco. But as Bobby traversed the jungles of the Ecuadorian Amazon and the frigid reaches of the Canadian wilderness, his personal life went through a major transition as he approached midlife. Not long after Kick was born, the couple began drifting apart. Emily had been his rock, as Bobby's friend Chris Bartle put it. Bobby needed the kind of assurance and support only she could provide. But the house was often filled with weekend guests from many walks of life, and Emily simply didn't possess Bobby's enthusiasm for socializing or competitive outdoor games. During the eighth year of their marriage in 1990, Emily decided to return to part-time lawyering after having been a stay-at-home mother since Bobby III's birthday. During the eighth year of their marriage in 1990, Emily decided to return to part-time lawyering after having been a stay-at-home mother since Bobby III's birth and worked mostly from home, but also shared an office in Tribeca with her best friend from law school. 2 years later, she and Bobby separated. They kept the house, but in April 1992, Emily took an apartment in the city and Bobby moved into the small cabin in the woods near the reservoir on Cross River. Bobby recalled, "We had been working on the relationship for several years, but it just could not be saved." He recorded in his journal at the time, "Emily said that her principal objective was to get through the divorce with dignity and love and support one another and try to feel out the steps God had laid out for us and trust the results would put us where he wants us to be and to protect the children and to get through this without anger and be good and supportive friends to each other." On March 17, 1994, Bobby spoke at a black tie dinner in Pennsylvania commemorating his father's return to public life there 30 years earlier. The next day, Hamilton Fish Jr. announced his retirement from the U.S. Congress because of a recurring prostate cancer. Politicians and press across New York, as well as members of his family, called Bobby urging him to run to fill the vacancy. "But I was going through a period that was difficult for my children, and I felt that I needed to give my attention to them. Once again, the timing wasn't right." There was no dispute over assets, and Bobby and Emily signed a separation agreement in May of 1994. That summer, Emily wrote to her former mother-in-law, Ethel, after Ethel reached out to her in a letter. "I have a lot to thank you for, Ethel. I have learned so much and grown through your example. Among other things, I've learned to face difficulty with courage and to get beyond it with generosity and an enduring sense of humor and appreciation for the joy in life. I feel lucky to have been part of your family and to have had that sense of belonging for these last years. I think you know that I will never love anyone as I have loved Bobby. I am grateful that we had each other to lean on while weathering the storms of young adulthood. I'm proud of all he's accomplished and will always support him in heart and spirit." Emily and Bobby agreed to share joint custody of Bobby III and Kick. Bobby had known Mary Richardson since she was 15. Like the Kennedys and the Skakels, she was raised in a large Irish-American Catholic family alongside six siblings. Her father, a professor and secretary of the faculty at Stevens Institute of Technology, had died of cancer when she was 12. Mary engaged in rebellion against her schoolteacher mother, much as the adolescent Bobby had with Ethel. "When you lose a parent young, you hold resentment against the surviving one," she once said. Around the same age that Bobby ran away from home, she'd gone off for 6 months to join a circus where all the performers slept together in a huge tent. Then, sent away to school in Europe, she moved in with an Italian prince. Her family scraped the money together to send Mary to the progressive co-ed Putney boarding school in Vermont. There, on the first day, she met another 15-year-old named Carrie Kennedy. They bonded instantly. "The next weekend, we hitchhiked to Boston," Carrie later recounted, "to see my siblings, Michael, Bobby, David, Courtney, and Kathleen, after which Mary spent nearly every weekend in vacation with our family." Roommates all through high school, Mary and Carrie continued to live together at Brown University and afterward while working in New York and Boston. "We were inseparable," Carrie would recall. "We shared friendships, a closet, a cash card. People couldn't tell our voices apart." Mary got straight A's at Brown and remained a stellar student at the Rhode Island School of Design. She had also grown into a tall beauty with long brunette hair, who dressed elegantly in black and craved adventure. As a kind of honorary Kennedy, she fit right into their milieu. When Carrie's older brother Joe started a nonprofit organization called Citizens Energy in 1979, primarily aimed at aiding low-income and elderly households by creating projects for discounted and free home heating services, Mary designed, wrote, and produced its first annual report. Launching a Manhattan career as an architectural designer, Mary was also becoming a master at securing donations for good causes and considered the challenge a contact sport. Like Bobby, she felt a powerful kinship with the people of Latin America. When the military cut off supplies to the poorest regions of El Salvador in the mid-1980s, Carrie recalled, she volunteered to help the RFK Center for Justice and Human Rights put together a truckload of food, clothes, and medical supplies for the mothers of the disappeared. With the help of Carrie's connections, Mary managed to ship 10 precious containers to the comadres. Carrie called her the kindest person I ever met, and she was that way to everybody, not just celebrities, but fishermen, cab drivers, and the guy who installed her floors. In 1986, Mary became active in Joe Kennedy's first successful run for the U.S. Congress in Massachusetts. She took a job as an architect at Parrish Hadley, a prestigious New York design firm, a few years later becoming part of a green team, renovating then-Vice President Al Gore's office, official Washington residence at the Naval Observatory. Mary also remained, in Carrie's eyes, a kind of Renaissance woman, a rafting guide on the Kennebec. She could build a campfire and on it cook a gourmet meal for 100, throw on a pot, weave a blanket, knit a hat, plumb a john, sponge paint a ceiling, and have a successful run as part of a girl group of go-go dancers in the cages at Studio 54. They continued to share a residence together until Carrie married Andrew Cuomo in 1990. Mary and Bobby became friends through Carrie, but there was no romantic relationship between them until the spring of 1993. Bobby would recall, "One day when I invited Mary to come to an art exhibit, the scales fell off my eyes. I suddenly saw her for the first time. I began dating her cautiously and fell deeply in love." He wrote in 2015, "I felt like she had been veiled in smoke all these years because I was not ready for the relationship. Now the smoke was lifted, and I was continually surprised at the depth of her character and baffled that I hadn't noticed those things before. It was like exploring a new country, climbing mountains and discovering from each new rich top another beautiful valley below, filled with adventure and laughter and surprises. By August 1993, I knew that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. She had everything I ever wanted. She was smart, thoughtful, honest, curious, brave, and beautiful. And I felt I had so much to learn about life and love from her. She had struggled and prevailed and gained wisdom in the process. We began living together in a shack on the Cross River Reservoir." Bobby also recalled that Emily really liked Mary, and we were living very nearby. When Emily left, she would ask the two of us to stay with the kids, and she loved the relationship Mary had with our children. Bobby 3 remembers, "When they first started dating, Mary was literally running the whitewater rafting trips as like an outfitter chef. She knew where every tent pole was. Bobby proposed to Mary on a trip to Ireland in Dublin's Phoenix Park, and they began planning a wedding for 9 months down the road. On March 24, 1994, he flew to the Dominican Republic to obtain the divorce from Emily. Numerous foreigners were doing similarly because the country's laws enabled someone to end a marriage in only a few hours. On April 15th, Lem Billings' birthday, Mary and Bobby were wed in a small ceremony on the deck of the Riverkeeper's research boat, the Shannon. They went fishing and caught a number of perch and cod, and after diving, kept some oyster shells as souvenirs. Bobby had just turned 40. And Mary would be 35 in the fall. They would move into the estate at Mount Kisco while Emily remained at the first Westchester home with the two children. Carrie and Andrew Cuomo would move a mile down the street to be close to Bobby and Mary. Carrie reflected years later, "I have never seen two people more thoroughly enchanted with one another and more completely in love. They brought out the best in one another and spoke about each other with wonder and awe. A healthy baby boy was born in July, on July 24, 1994. They named him Connor. Chapter 15, Luck of the Irish. In the summer of 1963, a few months before his death, President Kennedy had visited the Emerald Isle of his forebears and considered the trip one of the most moving experiences of his 42 years. "This is not the land of my birth," he said, "but it is the land for which I hold the greatest affection." He traveled with his youngest sister, Jean Kennedy Smith, from Shannon to Dublin, speaking to record crowds gathered along his route. In Dungeness, JFK visited Mary Kennedy Ryan, his third cousin, whom Bobby would also meet in later years. There, the family's heritage dated back to the 1700s, when they paid rent to an English landlord. The Kennedys educated their children in a secret hedge school and were among rare residents at Dungeness who could read and write. The president met with his Irish counterpart, Eamon D. Valera, to whom Jackie wrote following the assassination, "He never would have been president had he not been Irish. All the history of your people is a long one of overcoming obstacles." He felt the burden on that burden on him as a young Irishman in Boston, and he had so many obstacles in his life, his religion, his health. The people of Ireland had faced famine and disease and had fought against oppression and died for independence. Ireland was the British Empire's first colony and its last. In 1690, King William of Orange defeated Britain's Catholic King James II and his Irish allies at the Battle of the Boyne, dooming the final hope for Irish freedom. 5 years later, the Crown introduced retaliatory penal laws prohibiting Catholics from owning land or animals, getting educated, holding a public office, practicing a profession, serving on juries, voting, or practicing their religion. The law banished Catholic clergymen. For the next three centuries, the landless and bedraggled Irish Catholics lived lives of bullying and coercion on an island ruled by foreign government with a permanent military garrison. It's no wonder that Jack Kennedy, who knew his history well, nursed a lifelong antagonism to every variety of colonialism and imperialism and a wariness toward involving America in colonial wars. Following a 1916 rebellion, the Irish Republican Army, IRA, fought a bloody war against the British for 2.5 years. And then in 1920, the British negotiated a peace by splitting the island. 26 counties to the south, with their Catholic majority, became an independent republic ruled by its own parliament. The northern six counties, industrialized and wealthy, with Protestant majorities far outnumbering Catholics, remained as part of Great Britain, but also had their own parliament. The British gerrymandered the county lines to guarantee a permanent Protestant majority. The major police forces, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, RUC, and the Ulster Special Constabulary, were all Protestant and Unionist. A young generation of Catholics, inspired by the Kennedy presidency and Martin Luther King's peace marches, took to the streets of Northern Ireland to protest the centuries-old system of apartheid that kept them in impoverished ghettos. One of these was Paul Hill. He had grown up in West Belfast, where his merchant seaman father was a Protestant and his mother a Catholic. Hawking newspapers at age nine, he never forgot the sight of women weeping in the street when JFK was killed, or the photograph of the small, bare-legged boy in his winter coat offering a salute that his mother had him purchase from a local shopkeeper. It was John F. Kennedy Jr., 30 years later, Paul Hill would marry John's cousin. In response to the peaceful protests in the 60s, the Ulster Volunteer Force, a secretive paramilitary death squad, allied with the police, donate a series of bombs in Catholic neighborhoods. Sorry, not donated, detonated a series of bombs in Catholic neighborhoods. The Protestant RUC police force attacked civil rights marchers in Derry and beat two Catholic men to death. These deaths precipitated the worst rioting in the North since the 1930s. The Union government asked the British Army to come in and put down the rebellion, which they did. From Washington, Senator Ted Kennedy began voicing strong concerns and expressing support for the goals of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. His initial posture was confrontational to the British position. As the violence escalated, so did Teddy's rhetoric. In 1970, he delivered the bicentennial address at Trinity College in Dublin, condemning the British policy of internment without trial in Northern Ireland. To the exasperation of the British leadership, he called Northern Ireland Britain's Vietnam. Meanwhile, the ghetto fought back. Hundreds of women risked their lives by marching into the street to confront the British troops. The women's march broke the siege, but the violent response to the peaceful protests by army police and loyalists radicalized Catholics across the North and sent many young Irish flocking to join the IRA. As the British militarized the North, the IRA transitioned from a defensive police force to a guerrilla movement. The IRA became a terrorist organization, and it enjoyed broad support from Catholics in the United States. During Bobby's years at Harvard, every Irish pub in Boston and Cambridge had a jar on the bar collecting funds for an IRA surrogate. A state of virtual civil war existed as British troops patrolled Belfast streets and a Protestant paramilitary movement, the Ulster Defence Association, arose to hold on to Northern Ireland's place within the UK. In 1974, an elite IRA squadron unleashed a murderous bombing of two pubs near London that catered to British soldiers. 20-year-old Paul Hill, on the run from his parents, was asleep in his northern London flat at the time of the bombings in nearby Guildford. Overnight, though, Hill found himself falsely implicated by an older member of what became known as the Guildford Four. After several days of deprivation at the police station, Hill signed a confession with a cocked revolver in his mouth. He would receive a life sentence. Bobby recalled, he was really just a kid who wanted to sit in the pub and watch rugby. All of a sudden, he becomes the scapegoat for this IRA squad. He would have had some protection if they'd put him in the maze, the big prison where you're allowed to wear your own clothes and are treated more like a POW. But instead, they put him in British prisons and moved him 38 times. All the British criminals hated him because they looked at him as a terrorist. So Paul lived a nightmarish life for 15 years. If you can survive that, you can come away with some wisdom. A personal incident cemented Senator Kennedy's resolve to do something about the escalating violence. His niece, JFK's daughter Caroline, had secured a long, year-long internship at Sotheby's in London and was living with her friend Rebecca Fraser. She was the daughter of Hugh Fraser, a boyhood chum of JFK, and now a conservative member of parliament and vocal IRA critic. Bobby would soon meet Rebecca while enrolled at the London School of Economics. They started dating, and she would, for a time, become his fiancée. Every morning, Rebecca would drive Caroline to work in her father's red Jaguar. On October 23, 1975, the two young ladies were already on her front stoop when Fraser dashed back into the house to answer a ringing phone. Caroline waited in the hall. Minutes later, a time bomb planted under Fraser's car by IRA detonated and blew the car to tree level. The powerful blast knocked down Fraser and Caroline and cut them with flying glass. The phone call had saved their lives. In 1977, when Bobby was a junior at Harvard, living off campus in a small rental, Uncle Ted asked if John Hume could stay in his spare bedroom when he came to teach at the Kennedy School of Government in the spring. Senator Kennedy considered Hume a brilliant Northern Ireland parliamentarian, the best hope for bringing eventual unity to the troubled region. His advocacy of peaceful change and his condemnation of violence earned Hume the antipathy of both the IRA and the Ulster Death Squads. Both sides occasionally made attempts to murder him. Bobby first visited Ireland in 1978, where Hume showed him the neat bullet hole in the IRA sniper. Where Hume showed him the neat bullet hole that an IRA sniper had fired and missed in the living room of his modest home in Derry. Bobby Hill also traveled to Belfast with Rebecca Fraser. The city was racked with poverty, he remembered, a maze of narrow streets intersected Belfast's impoverished neighborhoods. Most of the homes were century-old, tiny two-ups with outside toilets. There were pubs on every corner and blocks of idle, abandoned mills and engineering factories. The Peace Line, a 30-foot-high barricade, divided the Catholic Falls Road from the Protestant Schenkel Road. Parts of the city looked like Germany after World War II, with piles of rubble, bomb debris, and entire blocks bombed out. Bobby's uncle persisted in his peace effort, co-founding Friends of Ireland in Congress in 1981. Four years later came the Anglo-Irish Agreement, where the British government acknowledged for the first time the role of the Irish government in Northern Ireland, including advising on human rights and policing. Initially, Britain's Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had opposed the agreement after the IRA tried to bomb her cabinet meeting. But Ted Kennedy reached out with the House Speaker Tip O'Neill and Bill Clark, President Reagan's Secretary of the Interior and a friend of Thatcher's, and persuaded her to endorse the arrangement. At the same time, a broad-based campaign, including clergy, politicians, and judges from Britain and Ireland, mounted support for the wrongly convicted Guildford Four. In 1989, an appeals court determined that detectives had manufactured the confessions, and three of the men gained their release. Paul Hill, however, was not among them. After serving 15 years, he was taken back to Belfast, having previously signed another coerced confession to the 1974 murder there of a British soldier. Refusing a deal for immediate parole if he would accept guilt, Hill vowed to fight the conviction. Freed anyway, after posting a small bail of some $6,000, he set to work fighting on behalf of the Birmingham Six, another group incarcerated under bogus charges. Hill helped win their release, and in a book called Stolen Years, recounted how all these cases had been trumped up by British intelligence as part of their covert war against IRA. The book would become the basis for the award-winning 1993 film In the Name of the Father. As a U.S. representative from Massachusetts, Bobby's older brother Joe had been one of the Guildford's four most vocal supporters in Congress. In 1990, he arranged for Hill and another ex-prisoner to address the Human Rights Caucus in Washington. Ethel Kennedy attended and was impressed enough to tell Hill afterward that she wished her daughter Courtney had been able to attend. Courtney had traveled with her sister Carrie to Ireland and felt like I was home, and later briefly enrolled at Dublin's Trinity College. Returning to New York in 1980, she married and later divorced a TV executive while working for the foundation named after her father. Hill was en route to address a law society in New York where Courtney was then recovering from a broken bone suffered in a skiing accident. At Ethel's impetus, the two arranged to meet for lunch. Courtney expected to meet someone shriveled up physically and mentally. "I couldn't understand a word he said," she recalled, hearing a Belfast accent delivered with such rapidity. "But I thought, he's gorgeous." She attended the lecture, He seemed to have this energy and this integrity, and they began a correspondence, then met up again in London. In March 1992, Courtney brought Paul up to Pace, where Bobby was teaching, and he gave a lecture about his jail experience in the British legal system. After a 3-year courtship, they married aboard a ship in the Aegean Sea. After a 3-year courtship, they married aboard a ship in the Aegean Sea in the summer of 1993, approaching Hill's 39th birthday, and soon moved to County Clare in Ireland. Earlier that year, at Ted Kennedy's request, newly elected President Bill Clinton had appointed his sister Jean as ambassador to Ireland. It was another violent year, with the Unionists killing IRA members and innocent Catholics with planted bombs. Hill's appeal of his conviction for the murder of British soldier Brian Shaw was scheduled for early March in 1994. Led by Courtney and their mother Ethel, a Kennedy contingent, including Bobby, Joe, Kathleen, Carrie, and Rory, flew to Belfast to lend their support. Bobby arrived on the morning of the 4th. The airline had lost my bag and I needed to buy a shirt for Courtney, remembers. A feud ensued because my driver, a Catholic, wanted to go to a Catholic mall. But the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, insisted we ride in the car with them to a Protestant center. We were attacked by the British press. When we entered the courtroom, Paul and Courtney were surrounded by the IRA people. A belligerent British soldier shouldered Joe, saying, "Why don't you go back to your home?" Joe replied, "Why don't you go back to yours?" Before the trial began, Hill explained to Bobby that it was British government strategy to encourage the Unionist terror organizations into sectarian violence, a false flag operation to make it appear as to the world as if it were a Catholic versus Protestant fray. The Kennedy clan was about to be on the receiving end. They were being shadowed by the terror boss of the Ulster Defense Association, Johnny Adair, or Adair, sorry. Once asked by a journalist if he'd ever had a Catholic in his car, Adair replied, "Only dead ones." He called himself Mad Dog, and he had the chops to prove it. Standing 5'3", his body was covered with tattoos. Since 1990, he had orchestrated a wave of terror in West Belfast that involved the murder of upward of 40 Catholics. An unpaid police informant, Mad Dog operated in collaboration with the British security forces and became a hero of the Loyalist movement. In 1989, Adair had driven the getaway car for a Loyalist death squad in the murder of Pat Finucane, an internationally revered human rights lawyer who often defended IRA prisoners. Finucane had just been returning from dinner in Dublin with Bobby's visiting sister Carrie when gunmen opened fire at his home in the presence of his family. Most recently, one of Mad Dog's men had thrown a grenade into the home of Jerry Adams. He was the leader of the Sinn Féin party in Parliament and a key player in the peace process who had forged an alliance with John Hume in 1993, seeking to persuade the IRA to put down its guns. Adams had stayed with Courtney and Hill at their London flat and was now the prime target of Mad Dog's Company C death squad. The bomb bounced off the hardened glass that saved his family, destroying his porch and front door. Adams had been sleeping in safe houses for security. So, as it often happened, the Kennedys were in the thick of it. Adair and his close associate, Winky Dodds, closely monitored the movements of the Kennedy clan as they began their 13-day courtroom vigil. An article in the Belfast Telegraph, July 24, 2008, would reveal Mad Dog's plan to ambush the Kennedy car as it made the daily trip from a Catholic church retreat in North Belfast to the Royal Courts of Justice. In an eerie deja vu of Dallas, Adair selected Downview Gardens near the Shore Road, end of Donegal Park Avenue, as the ideal point to attack when the vehicle had to slow down at a security ramp, providing an almost stationary target. He intended to fire a rocket-propelled grenade from a Russian PRG-7 launcher. Hill's wife, Courtney, was the primary target, but he knew that assassinating the other Kennedys with her would create the international incident he desired. Then Mad Dog made a serious mistake. He'd been attending a bail hearing for fellow loyalists at the nearby magistrate's court, then crossed the road to the High Court building where the third day of Hill's hearing was in progress. Police spotted him lingering in the courthouse for about 30 minutes, sparking an alert within the RUC special branch that led to extra security on the Kennedy family's route. The Belfast paper noted that details of the plot to blast the Kennedys had emerged only now, 14 years later, after members of Adair's notorious C Company had rebelled against his leadership earlier that year and had been debriefed by the new UDA leadership. In a memoir titled Mad Dog, published in 2009, Adair had described a planned ambush of an IRA group of sitting ducks along a planned route using a rocket launcher, but said nothing about a scenario involving the Kennedys. The verdict for Paul Hill came back on April 21, 1994. The Crown had argued that Hill couldn't have been threatened with a pistol for his testimony because the police station contained no weapons. But the Crown's case against him collapsed when two police officers admitted there having been guns in the precinct the night Paul had confessed. So the three Court of Appeals judges, wigged and in red robes, found that Hill's confession was coerced and exonerated him. Outside, Joe Kennedy made a statement on behalf of the family. "We're here to support my brother-in-law in his struggle for justice. Given the history of my family, I also want to let the Shaw family know that we know what it's like to be the victim of political violence. But one wrongful act should not condemn an innocent man for the rest of his life." Bobby remembers, "We drove to the monastery where everybody was staying for safety's sake after our hotel had a bomb threat. So now we drove on to a small town in Donegal. When our priest friend, Father Michael, tried to pull up for gas, Paul rolled down his window and said, 'Not here.' It was loyalist territory." That night, John Hume came to the hotel and Bobby went out to dinner with him and his wife. John had lost 20 pounds in the past year from worrying. He said he'd told Jerry Adams that the world had changed and the old arguments for their violence were no longer valid. I asked Hume what Adair's UDL would do if the IRA put away its guns. He told me they would kill for a while and then the British forces would be here solely to fight the UDL. That's why the UDL doesn't want the IRA to put down its arms. That is why they are threatening to kill me. John is now their number one assassination target. We were followed everywhere by the Irish police, who had intelligence of a death threat. But that night, in the wonderful Fish House restaurant off the fishing wharf, Catholics and Protestants all dined happily and conversed, including a Protestant leader who came over to talk with Hume. As Bobby put it, that was John's vision for the future of the North. A few weeks later, in May 1994, Mad Dog Adair was arrested and charged with directing terrorism. He ultimately received a 16-year jail sentence. That same year, after the IRA declared a complete cessation of military operations, Adair's UDA and a sister movement called their own ceasefires. Senator Kennedy visited Northern Ireland for the first time in January 1998. meeting with both unionists and nationalists in Belfast and Derry. The inclusive peace talks, chaired by former Senator George Mitchell, led to the Good Friday Peace Agreement that April, the most promising opportunity. Sorry, that did not sound right. The inclusive peace talks, chaired by the former Senator George Mitchell, led to the Good Friday Peace Agreement that April, the most promising opportunity for lasting peace in the three-decade-old conflict in Northern Ireland. For the most part, it's worked. After serving his time, Mad Dog Adair came out of prison and settled in Scotland, where early in 2021, he spoke in an interview about John Hume coming to visit him in May's prison and convincing Mad Dog and his followers to maintain the ceasefire that they'd been considering abandoning. Hume had died in the summer of 2020. Mad Dog said, "John Hume wanted peace, and he was prepared to speak to anyone or go anywhere to bring it about. There's no doubt John Hume persuaded us. He won us over, and we decided to give it a go. John Hume was a good man, and he deserves his place in history." Things seem to have come full circle. Bobby tells a story courtesy of Paul Hill. Two Irishmen were walking down the road after the Good Friday Treaty was signed, and one said to the other, "Do you realize this is the first day of peace in 700 years? We've been at war for 7 centuries. And the other replied wistfully, ah, yes, but weren't it great while it lasted?" And that is the end of chapter 15. Chapter 16 is next. We'll do that next time. It's called Watershed Moments. And it's a longer chapter, so I'll probably just do that one. Maybe I'll get to, let's see, let me just check it out. The next, chapter 17, is Riverkeeper Meets the Styx. Well, we'll see. We might get 2 chapters in next time. All right. Hope you're enjoying the story. Thank you for listening.